Our Coon's grand strategy for the morrow would be to split his forces into four raiding parties. They would hide among the rocks and rush out, seize a few hostages, slit a few throats, and then run for it. You are one of the great generals of history, I told Our Coon. I would like to write a scroll to extol your genius. He liked the idea and promised to provide me with whatever materials I required for the project as soon as we returned to Adbar Seged. It seemed that King Prester Beni John was a commander of equal panache and vision. We met his forces the following day in a wide valley with steep sides. The battlefield had been mutually agreed upon some months in advance, and Prester Beni John had taken up his position at the head of the valley before we arrived. We came forward to shout insults and challenges at Our Coon from a safe distance. Prester Beni John was a stick of a man, thin as a staff, with a long white beard and silver locks down to his waist. I could not make out his features over that distance, but the women had told me that as a young man he had been the most handsome swain in Ethiopia, and that he had 200 wives. Some women had killed themselves for love of him. It seemed clear to me that his talents might be more gainfully employed in the harem than on the battlefield. Once Prester Beni John had had his say, Our Coon went forward and replied at length. His insults were flowery and poetic. They rolled off the cliffs and echoed down the gorge. I committed some of his pithier remarks to memory, for they were worth recording. When Our Coon subsided at last, I expected that battle would be joined, but I was mistaken. There were several other warriors on both sides who wished to speak. I fell asleep against a rock in the warm sun, smiling to myself as I imagined what sport Tanos and a company of his blues would enjoy against these Ethiopian champions of rhetoric. It was afternoon when I woke and started up at the clash of arms. Our Coon had loosed his first assault. One of his detachments raced forward against Prester Beni John's positions, beating their swords against their copper shields. Within a remarkably short space of time, they returned with greater alacrity to their starting point, without having inflicted or suffered casualties. Further insults were exchanged, and then it was Prester Beni John's turn to attack. He charged and retired with equal verve and similar results. So the day passed, insult for insult, charge for charge. At nightfall, both armies retired. We camped at the foot of the valley, and Our Coon sent for me. "What a battle!" he greeted me triumphantly as I entered his tent. "It will be many months before Prester Beni John will dare take the field again." "There will be no battle on the morrow?" I asked. "Tomorrow we will return to Adbar Seged," he told me, "and you will write a full account of my victory in your scrolls. I expect that after this salutary defeat, Prester Beni John will soon sue for peace." Seven of our men had been wounded in this ferocious encounter, all by arrows fired at extreme range. I drew the barbs and dressed and bandaged the wounds. The following day I saw the wounded loaded onto the litters and walked beside them as we started back. One of the men had received a stomach wound and was in much pain. I knew he would be dead from gangrene within the week, but I did my best to ease his suffering and to cushion the bouncing of the litter over the rougher sections of the track. Late that afternoon we came to a ford in the river, one that we had crossed on our way to give battle to Prester Beni John. I had recognised this ford from the description that Masara had given me of the countryside and the route to her father's stronghold. The river was one of the numerous tributaries of the Nile that descended from the mountains. There had been rain over the preceding days, and the level of the ford was high. I began the crossing, wading beside the litter of my patient with the stomach wound. He was already delirious. Halfway across the ford I realized that we had underestimated the height and strength of the water. The flood caught the side of the litter and swung it sideways. It twisted the horse around, dragging the poor animal into deeper water where its hooves lost purchase on the gravel bottom. I was hanging onto the harness, and the next moment the horse and I were both swimming. We were washed away downstream in the icy green flood. The wounded man was tumbled out of the litter, and when I tried to reach him, I lost my hold on the horse's harness. We were swept apart. The wounded man's head disappeared below the surface, but by this time I was swimming for my own life. I rolled onto my back and pointed my feet downstream. This way I was able to fend off the rocks with my feet as the current hurled me against them. For a short while, some of Akun's men ran along the bank beside me, but soon the river swept me through a bend and they could not find a way around the base of the cliff. The horse and I were alone in the river. Below the bend, the speed of the current slackened, and I was able to swim back to the horse and throw one arm over its neck. For the moment, I was safe. For the first time, I thought of escape, and realized that the gods had made an opportunity for me. I muttered a prayer of thanks, and used a handful of the horse's mane to steer it on down the middle of the river. We had come downstream several miles, and it was dark before I steered my horse into the bank. We clambered ashore on a sandbar. I judged that I was safe from pursuit and recapture until morning. None of Akun's men would venture down the gorge in darkness. However, I was so chilled that my whole body shivered in uncontrollable spasms. I led the horse to a sheltered place out of the wind and then pressed my body to his flank. His wet hide steamed in the moonlight. Gradually, the warmth of the animal permeated me, and my shivering subsided. Once I was half warmed, I was able to gather up driftwood from the sandbank. Using the Shilluk method, I managed with much difficulty to start a fire. I spread my robes out to dry, and crouched over the fire for the rest of that night. As soon as it was light enough to see the path, I dressed myself and mounted the horse. I headed away from the river, for I knew that Akun's men would concentrate their search along the banks. 2 days later, following the directions that Masara had given me, I reached one of the fortified hilltop villages in the domain of Prester Beni John. The head man of the village expressed the intention of cutting my throat immediately and taking my horse. I made full use of all my persuasive gifts, and eventually he agreed to keep the horse, but lead me to the fortress of Prester Beni John. The guides who were escorting me to King Prester Beni John spoke of him in warm and affectionate terms. The villages that we passed along the way were cleaner and more prosperous than those of Akun. The herds of kine were fatter, the crops well cultivated, and the people better fed. The horses I saw were magnificent. Their beauty brought tears to my eyes. When at last we came in sight of the castle, high on another amber, it was in a better state of repair than that of Akun, and no grisly trophies decorated the walls. From close at hand, King Prester Beni John was indeed an extremely handsome man. His silver hair and beard endowed him with a singular air of dignity. His complexion was fair, and his eyes dark and intelligent. At first he was highly sceptical of my story, but gradually his manner changed towards me as I recited the intimate knowledge with which Masara had armed me. He was deeply affected by the messages of love and duty that I brought to him from his daughter, and he questioned me eagerly as to her health and welfare. Then his servants led me to quarters that, by Ethiopian standards, were sumptuous, and I was provided with fresh woolen robes to replace my rags. After I had eaten and rested, the servants led me back to the dank and smoky cell that was Prester Beni John's audience chamber. "Your Majesty, Masara has been a prisoner of Akun these past 2 years," I pointed out to him immediately. "She is a young and tender girl. She pines away in his stinking dungeons." I embroidered the facts a trifle, to bring home to him the urgency of her plight. "I have tried to assemble the ransom that Akun demands for my daughter," Prester Beni John excused himself, "but I would have to smelt down every plate and bowl in Aksum to put together such a hoard of silver as would satisfy his greed. In addition, he demands great tracts of my land and scores of my principal villages. To relinquish these to him would weaken my realm and condemn tens of thousands of my subjects to his tyranny. I could lead your army to his stronghold of Adbar Serged. You could lay siege to the castle and force him to hand over Masara to you." Prester Beni John looked startled by this proposal. I do not think such a course of action had occurred to him. It was not the Ethiopian way of waging war. "I know Adbar Serged very well, but it is impregnable," he answered me primly. "Akun has a mighty army at his back. We have fought many fierce battles against him. My men are lions, but we have never been able to defeat him." I had seen the lions of Prester Beni John in battle, and I saw that his estimate of the situation was correct. The army he commanded could never hope to storm Adbar Serged and free Masara by force of arms. The following day I returned with another proposal. "Great Emperor of Aksum, King of Kings, as you well know, I am of the Egyptian nation. Queen Lostris, the regent of Egypt, lies with her armies at the confluence of the two rivers, where the Nile meets its twin." He nodded. "This I know. These Egyptians have entered my territory without my leave. They are digging mines in my valleys. Soon I will fall upon them and annihilate them. It was my turn to be startled. Prester Benny John was aware of the work on Pharaoh's tomb, and our people there were in danger of attack. Accordingly, I modified the suggestion that I was about to put to him. "My people are skilled in the art of siege and war," I explained. "I have influence with Queen Lostris. If you send me safely back to her side, I will prevail on her to extend you her friendship. Her troops will storm the fortress of Adbar Serged and free your daughter." Although Prester Benny John tried to disguise the fact, I saw that my suggestion appealed to him. "What would your queen require in return for her friendship?" he asked carefully. We haggled for 5 days, but in the end the bargain was struck. "You will allow Queen Lostris to continue the mining work in your valley, and you will declare those valleys a prohibited area. Your own people will be forbidden to enter there on pain of death," I told him. This was for my mistress. It would secure the tomb of Pharaoh from desecration. "I agree," said Prester Benny John. "You will deliver to Queen Lostris 2,000 horses that I will choose from your herds." This was for me.
1,000,
said the king.
2,000.
I was firm.
"I agree," said Prester Benny John.
"Once she is free, the Princess Marsara shall be allowed to marry any man she chooses. You will not forbid it." That was for Memnon and the girl.
"It is against our custom," he sighed, "but I agree. When we capture them, Akun and the stronghold of Adbar Serged will be handed over to you."
He looked more cheerful and nodded vigorously.
"Finally, we Egyptians shall be allowed to keep all the spoils of war that we capture from Akun, including the legendary blue sword."
That was for Tanus.
"I agree," said Prester Benny John, and I could see that he thought that he'd made a bargain. He gave me an escort of 50 men, and I set out the following day on the return to Kebui, riding a fine stallion that was the king's parting gift to me. We were still 5 days' ride from Kibui when I saw the swift dust cloud ahead of us, racing towards us across the plain. Then I saw the chariots dancing through the heat mirage. As they approached, the columns deployed into attack formation at the gallop. It was beautiful to watch. The dressing was perfect, and the spacing between each vehicle so exact that they looked like a string of beads. I wondered who commanded them. I shaded my eyes as they drew closer, and my heart leapt as I recognized the horses of the leading chariot. They were Rock and Chain, my own darlings. However, I did not immediately recognize the charioteer behind them. It was almost 3 years since last I had laid eyes on Memnon. The difference in age between 17 and 20 is the difference between the boy and the man. I had taken to riding with saddle cloth and stirrups in the Ethiopian manner, and so now I stood high in the stirrups and waved. I saw the chariot swerve as Memnon recognized me and whipped up the team to full charge. "Mem!" I howled. "Mem!" And his answering shout came back to me on the wind. "Tata! By the sweet milk of Isis, it's you!" He pulled up the horses, sprang from the footplate, and dragged me from my horse. First he hugged me, then he held me at arm's length, and we studied each other avidly. "You are pale and thin, Tata. The bones are sticking out of you. Are those grey hairs I see here?" I tugged at my temples. He was taller than I was now, lean in the waist and broad in the shoulder. His skin was tanned and oiled to the colour of burnished amber, and cords of muscle stood out in his throat when he laughed. He wore wrist guards of gold and the gold of valour on his bared chest. Although it seemed impossible, he was more handsome than when I had last seen him. He reminded me of a leopard, supple and sleek. He lifted me bodily and set me on the footplate of the chariot. "Take up the traces," he ordered. "I want to see if you have lost any of your old skill."
"Which way?" I asked.
"West, to Kibui, of course," he ordered. "My mother will be angry if I do not bring you directly to her."